See, China's state media reported that the PLA Navy had completed the development of the world's most powerful and sensitive low-frequency communication system for nuclear submarines. Let me drop for a second. What described the technology as having the world's largest communications distance and deepest communication depth, according to the official report. The U.S. Navy shut down its Wisconsin transmitter in 2004, saying it no longer needed to rely on ELF radios. Instead, the U.S. Naval nuclear submarine fleet uses a very low frequency, or VLF, radio wave with frequencies ranging from 3 to 30 kilohertz for long-distance communication. The VLF radio waves can carry more information than the ELF signals because of its higher frequency and can penetrate seawater to a depth of up to 40 meters. That's about 130 feet. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Medicine can be a little bit like Star Wars at times. There are those who follow the light side of the force and others more intrigued by the darker, not actually proven side of medicine. Up until recently, this was mostly unproven megavitamin therapy with some unproven chelation therapy thrown in to remove supposed heavy metal contaminants. But recently, some are tinkering around with a unproven random stem cell injection. Public health experts have been warning us about clinics offering unapproved and untested stem cell treatments for some time now. But a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention underscore the health risks these procedures can have. An outbreak linked to stem cell injections contaminated with bacteria sickened at least 12 people this year, the report found. According to the report, the first whiff of the outbreak came in September when Texas health officials learned of three cases in which people got serious infection after receiving a stem cell treatment at an outpatient clinic. That same month, Florida officials reported another four cases from between February and August. Since then, there have been three other cases reported in Texas, along with one in Arizona, though all of the patients were hospitalized with infections, some for over a month. Fortunately, none of them died. Let me drop for a second. The infections were all linked to stem cell products distributed by a California company called Livion. Livion, in turn, had obtained its product, processed from the umbilical cords donated after birth, from a biotech company called Genentech. Now, mind you, not Genentech, which we all know and love. This was called Genentech. Supplies of unused stem cells products at the affected clinics were found to be contaminated with bacteria, including E. coli and Proteus mirabilis, which commonly infect wounds. And similar strains of these bacteria were also found in the sickened patient. So, it's likely the contamination happened before the products ended up in the clinics. Now, stem cells are immature cells that can transform into other kinds of cells. They are of interest to scientists who are eager to use them to regrow or heal damaged parts of the body. Currently, though, stem cell products processed from umbilical cords are only approved to help restore a person's immune system or supply a source of stem cells, usually following treatments like chemotherapy or bone marrow transplants. But nearly all of these patients who were sickened had received the stem cells for unproven conditions like nerve pain or joint problems. Let me drop for a second. In late September, Livion issued a voluntary recall of its Genentech source products and announced it would discontinue its use of the product. But that seemingly hasn't been enough for the Food and Drug Administration. Last week, the agency once again issued a warning to Genentech over the unapproved use and marketing of these products, as well as its lack of good safety practices. It also sent letters to other clinics and companies selling off-label stem cell treatments, reminding them that the regulations surrounding stem cell treatment. As things stand, companies technically have until November 2020 to file their stem cell product for approval with the FDA, either as a new drug or as a pre-market approval, meaning the product would be considered as safe as products already on the market. Until then, the agency has promised to be lenient in how it regulates companies and clinics currently selling off-label stem cell treatments, depending upon how these products are used and the risks that they might pose to consumers. But Scott Leaf warned that the agency would be aggressive going after companies and clinics that are getting people sick. As an aside, in March of last year, it was reported that three Floridians were blinded after a dubious attempt to treat their macular degeneration with untested stem cell injection. Let me drop for a second. Back at the FDA, the letters were issued today to manufacturers, healthcare providers, and clinics around the country as a reminder that there's a clear line between appropriate development of these products and practices that sidestep important regulatory controls needed to protect patients. Time is running out for the firms to come into compliance during their period of enforced discretion, he said in a statement. Scientists and researchers, meanwhile, have criticized the FDA for its tolerance of these clinics. Several studies have shown that clinics in both the United States and elsewhere are frequently claiming to treat everything from Alzheimer's disease to HIV with the help of stem cells, claims that are not yet supported by any strong evidence. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, here's another one at you. Americans have continued to get bigger, but not any taller since the turn of the millennium. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has found. According to the report, the average adult American's weight and waistline have both expanded over the past 18 years, while the average adult's height has stayed flat, if not shrunken a bit. The report is based on data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, a regularly conducted poll and interview of Americans' dieting and lifestyle habits. As part of the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, a selected and nationally representative group of volunteers undergo a physical examination. The author looked at the data from 1999 to 2000 version of the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey and compared it to the data taken from the 2015-2016 version, which accounted for more than 40,000 people in total. They averaged out the weights of both adult men and women according for factors like age. From 1999 to 2000, the weight of the average adult man was 189.4 pounds, but from 2015 to 2016, that average weight had ballooned up to 197.9 pounds. The average adult man was 163.8 pounds from 1999 to 2000, but 170.6 pounds from 2015 to 2016. Both men saw their waistlines increase by more than an inch since 1999 as well, with men now sporting an average 40.2-inch waistline and women having a 38.6-inch waistline. Let me drop for a second. Meanwhile, the average man was 69.2 inches tall from 1999 to 2000, but was only 69.1 inches from 2015 to 2016. And the average woman was 63.8 inches tall from 1999 to 2000, but only 63.7 inches from 2015 to 2016. The new report is a successor to the report by the CDC published in 2004. That report, which looked at trends reaching back to the 1960s, found that American adult men and women had gained an average 24 pounds and grown an extra inch between 1960 to 2002. The current rise in weight isn't quite as dramatic as it was back then, but the findings are a sign that reported recent increases in body mass index, or BMI, is capturing an important trend. Some experts and activists have criticized body mass index, which relies on our weight and height, as a flawed metric for figuring out when someone's size might be at an unhealthy level and have pushed for other measurements like waist circumference to be used instead. One of the arguments for letting go of the body mass index is that dramatic height differences, such as being very tall or short, can skew the results, classifying some people as obese who might otherwise be healthy, while others might have a normal body mass index and still be unhealthy. But if Americans overall are getting heavier and staying the same height, and if those statistics are reflected in recent body mass index trends, that suggests body mass index is acting as a reliable barometer of whether American bodies are becoming on average, less healthy over time. Let me drop for a second. So, the bottom line is that Americans are becoming heavier on average, a trend which is reflected in this new data, and this added weight is accounting for a rise in obesity. And obesity continues to be linked to a higher risk of numerous health conditions, particularly type 2 diabetes. So, just say no to that extra donut next time. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Intuition.
Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, for the past 15 years, there is 10.7 million unauthorized immigrants living in the U.S. from South of America. Isn't that actually causing that statistics looks like they look like? And to XGN.
I don't think there's a particular trend of obesity south of the border, at least not that I really have heard about. And again, I think that they have done a demographic survey to mix up the groups of people so that you're not getting a large contingent of people who slip past the border. So I think, and looking at the general population, it's not personally surprising that Americans are growing more and more overweight. I don't know if you've seen the same trend, but I see more and more people heavier and heavier.
There was a time when I was analyzing U.S. Census Bureau and the government surveys, and actually it's not 10.7, it's 12.2 million. Now they have a very much specific body build, and they are not tall. So then they are in here, and they have a children, and it is expected the children are not much taller than the parents. And that mixed up with obesity of Americans that were here before that might lead to wrong conclusions and to actually.
Okay, Wes, I mean, it certainly is possible that new, either legal or illegal immigration is favoring people with slightly different phenotypes, different body shapes, that cause the height drop. I don't know if it really means the increase in total body weight. Again, my patients, who none of them, I think, skirted over the border, generally weight is a never-ending problem in our country because it's such a country of wealth and food is cheap, relatively speaking, and it's marketed very, very well by marketers, and, you know, people like fatty, high caloric foods. Taste better to them. We've evolved to prefer them, and people can be rather gluttonous.
It is possible. Well, I just made that conclusion. I'm not sure if that is true, but it's quite possible. I have a question in different nature after you finish in waveguides, but that make a phone back to you.
Okay, Wes, I mean, basically, if it's a question regarding waveguides, we have an electrical engineer here who probably knows a heck of a lot more about waveguides than I'll ever learn.
It's a short question. If you allow me, I can ask a question.
Yeah, sure, Wesley. Let her rip.
What is the difference between waveguides and slotted line in terms of losses? I mean, we both know what it is. How much of energy would be accumulated in the waveguide that is, let's say, 2 inches by 2 inches, and we immerse the probe like in the slotted line? And to XGN.
Well, Dick, do you have any words of wisdom on this topic? Since I've never really worked with either slotted lines or waveguides, I would assume, again, it's a complicated thing and has to do with the design of both of those devices as far as efficiencies and such, but what do I know?
The way slotted line is constructed, it usually is made out of relatively low-profile printed circuit-like material with high dielectric constant materials inside of the slot. Waveguide is usually metallic with air on the inside and having a much larger cross-section. Because of the usual way of implementation, slotted line should be quite a bit more lossy in dB per foot than waveguide. Over to you, Wes, K2IW.
Okay. Now, in slotted line and the same in a waveguide, you immerse the probe and you're trying to find out how much energy you could accumulate. Just rough idea. And we're not going to very much specific on this probe and tricks here.
Almost any of these structures require a launching structure, a launching facility. Most single generators come out with a coaxial cable. So coax to waveguide transition and coax to slotted line transition. These transition devices are pretty well documented in microwave theory and techniques, been around for a long time. And so the problem is getting a good impedance match across a particular band of frequencies. The launching structure is not where the loss is coming from. Almost anything that has loss has length to it. The usual length of an adapter, for instance, is so short it has no real loss, no matter how you make it. 100 feet of coax cable is going to have a lot of loss. The inch and a half of an adapter, or the inch and a half of a waveguide to coax adapter, that has no real loss. Over to US, K2IW.
Okay. Now, my last question was, I'm immersing the probe into the waveguide, like I did with the slotted line. How much of the energy can I accumulate, just a rough idea, on that probe that is immersed, and how deep that probe must be immersed into the waveguide, into X-ray?
In the case of a coax to waveguide launching structure, the probe inside really is a ground plane antenna, and the nearby waveguide is the ground plane. It's a vertically polarized ground plane antenna. It usually is mounted close to a quarter wavelength against away from a short circuit at one end, so it launches the signal in the other end. The probe itself probably has a Q of around 5 or so. So once you know its Q, you know the amount of stored resonant energy in it. And if you have to run a megawatt into your waveguide to coax adapter, there's ways of making that probe very fat in diameter with rounded edges so that it can tolerate a much larger power without arcing over and without creating corona discharge. There's all kinds of ways of doing that. Over to you, Wes, K2IW.
Okay, the last question of mine. There's a small device you worked with that before. I remember when we were talking about polarization. There is XYZ isotropic probe. Holiday makes one, I believe 4417. I would like to know. So it's XYZ. I didn't work with that. I have it. What is your experience with that? And please share.
The waveguide to coax adapter, because of the environment it is in, is launching a signal in one direction only, with usually one polarization only. So the signal gets launched down the guide in the Z direction, so to speak. All other directions become reflective and part of the impedance matching procedure as to how long is the probe and how close it is to the backplane wall of US K2IW.
Thank you very much for that information. I'm very much satisfied with your help. Now, I was asking you a quite different question. there is a small device, like you hold in your hand, the small antenna, which has a X, Y, Z, three axes written on it. And it's a small box that is connected with, let's say, fiber cable into it. Holiday made one, that is an American company, then was purchased by CTS. I believe you're familiar with those devices when you were working with them in anechoic chambers and to a chain.
I'm not familiar with the device that you're describing, Wes.
Okay. That's another time I'm going to ask for it. I have a device. What I'm trying to do is work on trying to determine vertical polarization of an antenna, make sure that it's there, and that's in near field and far field, and the device does it. But I don't want to just shorten the time of Dr. Roy. Dr. Roy, pick up.
Okay, thank you very much, Wes. It's no problem if anyone has any questions that are off topic, as long as no one has any questions that's on topic, I'm perfectly happy with that. Let's have this little talk lead to another puzzle. Maybe people would like a puzzle at this point. We talked about the phase change diagrams a while ago. We talked about how water freezing is exothermic, it gives off heat. Water evaporating or boiling takes in heat, it's exothermic. So I thought maybe we could kind of pose a puzzle of if you do something different. Phase change diagrams usually have the y-axis is pressure and the x-axis is temperature, and then there are areas where it's liquid, solid, and gaseous. And, you know, there's very fancy plasma and all kinds of fun stuff. Nevertheless, let's add another nuance to it. You have a glass of water. You place, say, about 40 grams. You put 40 grams of salt in it. What happens at freezing point? Any takers?
The freezing point should drop, if I understand it all correctly. KC2SHO.
Okay, John, anyone else?
The freezing point gets depressed, WA to VDH by.
Okay, you're both quite right. It's the freezing point gets depressed, and that's primarily why people throw salt on the sidewalk. It adds a little grit, but it also lowers the melting point, so that if it's just at usual point of 32 degrees, you got a better chance of it melting. So it depresses the freezing point. Next question is, what happens when you're trying to boil water and you drop all that salt into it? Does adding salt to water lower the boiling point or raise the boiling point?
Boiling point gets elevated, right?
Okay, you guys are too smart for me. Yes, it's not as severe an effect of the same amount of salt will lower the freezing point to a much greater degree, but adding any kind of solvent that's dissolvable in a solvent will raise its boiling point. That's adding salt lowers the freezing point, raises the boiling point. There's apparently a whole bunch of people out there who think that if they sprinkle salt in their hot water, it'll boil faster. It won't. It'll boil at around the same point because, again, the boiling point elevation is not terribly different with or without the salt.
An interesting question, Roy, is what happens to the volume of the water when you dissolve salt into it? If I've got 30 cc's of water, and I take a 1 cc of granular salt and dissolve it into it, Do I still have 30 cc's of liquid left over?
Again, I'm not 100% sure about this. I think there is a slight increase in the volume, but it's nowhere close to summing the volume of the water and the salt crystals. But I think there is an infinitesimal increase in the volume of that mixture.
Yeah, there I'm not sure. In your opinion, though, Loy, is right. Is there a simple way of explaining at the molecular level what is going on with salt dissolved in water that causes its freezing temperature to be depressed? What's going on at the molecular level that causes that? Is it because it's making a different kind of a substructure, so to speak, the crystalline structure? Is the crystalline structure of salt and water different than ordinary water without the salt? Over to you, Roy.
No, when water freezes, it forms the same type of crystal even with salt intercalated in it. It produces crystal defects, but it doesn't modify the shape of the underlying crystal. And the thing that makes it thermodynamically a lower freezing point is that problem where the sodium atoms get intercalated in the crystal structure and it becomes somewhat more difficult for the crystals to form, and so they require a lower thermal energy to do that. So that would be my way of describing why you have a freezing point depression dissolving any kind of a solute into a solvent. Okay, anything else on this subject or any other subject that interests people? Otherwise, I'll go on to my next little article here.
Well, since I've moved to a higher altitude, I've often been confronted with the concerns of this subject and altitude, if you wanted to touch on that. It's KC2SHO.
Oh, that was a strange courtesy talk. Yeah, we actually covered that the last time, that the phase change, as I said, is a function of temperature and pressure. At higher altitudes, you have less atmospheric pressure. At a lower vapor pressure, water in equilibrium as a liquid and as a gas tends to become a gas more readily, so the amount of heat that you have to introduce into the system becomes less, so water boils at a lower temperature, and what you're used to boiling an egg at 100 degrees centigrade is now, you know, 99 or 98 degrees centigrade.
Copy, West to end.
Yes, Paul.
I know John isn't as high in altitude as Denver, but, you know, I lived there a couple of years, and they had a four-minute egg everywhere you went. You know, if you went to a restaurant, it was 4 minutes, not 3 minutes, because the it was 5,000 feet, you know, roughly a mile above sea level. So I wonder if John has that in Los Alamos.
Well, currently I'm living at about 6,000 feet. Los Alamos proper is 7,000 feet, give or take, depending where you are in town. So we're actually higher here. It probably takes longer.
If you make the air pressure low enough, I think you can boil water at approximately 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, you basically can arrange for it to sublime from the solid to the gas.
But liquid water at 32.1 degrees Fahrenheit, if I make the air pressure low enough, it will boil. So one way of looking at it is that the water molecules are moving around at a particular speed on average because of the temperature they're at. The ones that roar up to the surface stand a certain probability of jumping off the surface. Whether they jump off the surface and become a gas is partially a function of how much air pressure there is at that surface suppressing that evaporation-like process. That's one way I look at it. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
Yeah, Dick, I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate way of doing it. You have to kind of understand that these are all really ultimately equilibrium equations. You know, nothing just spontaneously goes from solid to liquid, liquid to gas. There's an interface where there's a back and forth type of motion. Depending upon the external factors, it either pushes it in one direction or it pushes it in the other. As you decrease the general environmental pressures, you require far less energy to propel an errant water molecule into the air and change it to basically a gas vapor. So as you go down in pressure, you can get an ice cube that just kind of disappears as it just kind of turns into gas. So that's one of the reasons why you see in a lot of real reasonable science fiction movies where astronauts, where the equipment malfunctions and basically the water in their bodies start to boil off in the vacuum of space. Okay, any other comments, questions, or statements at this point, or I'll move on to the next topic?
KD2MBB.
Yes, Bob.
Wasn't that true with dry ice, carbon dioxide? It does not really turn into a liquid, at least at our pressures here on Earth.
Yes, Bob, that's absolutely right. It sublimates at one atmosphere. It doesn't possess a water phase. Again, if you look at carbon dioxide, and it has a phase diagram as well. There are different pressures where you will be able to, if you increase the pressure high enough, you can come up with liquid carbon dioxide. But at one atmosphere pressure, there is no area in the phase change curve that exists for it in one atmosphere. So it goes from a solid of dry to the gaseous carbon dioxide.
WS to us.
Yes, Paul.
What you said about the ice changing directly to gas, they went through that with the Phoenix lander that had landed on Mars back in 07. You know, it had a scoop on, a robotic arm with a scoop, and it dug into the ground, and NASA took pictures, as it was doing it, and they found ice there, very small chunks of ice under the surface. And then they went back the next day after the sun was out, and that ice was gone, so it just supplemented. It just disappeared. It never turned to water. It just turned to a gas and went away. But for the same reason, you only got less than one one hundredth of the amount of pressure on Mars than here, so you have the low temperatures. It just went away. So in the second picture.
Yeah, Paul, it's nice to know that chemistry is universal. You don't even need space to see ice sublimating. I think I mentioned a while ago here. If you were to take a ice cube tray and put it in the freezer and keep the freezer going forever and ever, eventually, the rate is very low, but eventually the ice cubes would slowly disappear, and what's happening is they're sublimating into air vapor. Then they condense on the side walls, and they develop those lovely little ice crystals that you buy an extra defrosting circuit in your freezer for. And so ice will even sublimate at normal pressures. It just does it a lot faster at lower pressures. Okay, anything else on this subject? I got a short one to kind of put a bow on it. Okay, this is a callback to a previous story that I said a few weeks ago. We discussed a Chinese geneticist, and he announced he was working with very few restrictions, and China was inventing even new methods of coercion for their unruly scientists these days. to tackle widespread scientific misconduct. The Chinese government has expanded its controversial social credit system to include infractions made by research scientists. The plan would scare some to straight, but the potential for abuse is very, very real. Researchers in China who commit scientific misconduct could soon be prevented from getting a bank loan, running a company, or applying for a public service job, reports science writer David Cyranowski at Nature News. Previously, it was China's science ministry and its universities that had the power to police and punish offending scientists, but now dozens of government agencies have been bestowed power to mete out the penalty. So, in addition to losing funding and awards, researchers now face restrictions outside of academia and in domains that have nothing to do with research. This may seem like a knee-jerk reaction to that Chinese scientist, Yi Zhangku, a stunningly irresponsible gene-editing experiment, the details of which were disclosed late last month. He admitted to using CRISPR gene-editing tool to modify human embryos that are now twin babies, despite the immature state of the technology. Moreover, the scientist, he conducted the research in secret and failed to go through normal channels. Among other alleged indiscretions, China's government shut him down, his project, and launched an investigation. After weeks of uncertainty surrounding his whereabouts, the New York Times learned that the government had placed the researcher under house arrest at a housing facility in the...
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Can't leave. Guards prevent people from getting close either. His de facto residence, or the offices involved in his research, is out of bounds then. His fate appears to have worsened over time, even. Recent news articles report that he very possibly could face corruption and bribery charges, both of which carry the death penalty in China. Most of his staff might end up fired and unemployable in their chosen fields. Let me drop for a second. The announcement that China's social credit system will now include research scientists certainly jives with this still ongoing episode, but the new policy is an effort to address endemic scientific misconduct within the Chinese research community as a whole. There's been widespread reports, for example, of Chinese research faking data, falsifying curriculum vitae, and that's an autobiography, kind of list, a resume, if you will, and faking peer reviews. Earlier this year, the Chinese government said it was going to finally crack down on academic misconduct and introduce new reforms, including the introduction of a national naughty list of offenders, the members of which could be disqualified from future funding or research positions, and even prevent them from getting jobs outside of academia. China is in the process of introducing a sweeping and lifelong social ranking system, the credo of which is, once untrustworthy, always restricted. In stark works of China's President Xi Jinping, the system was launched in 2013 and now includes nearly 10 million people. The system should be fully implemented in the next 2 or 3 years and include some 22 million citizens. Let me drop for a second. The program works by marking individuals who have violated laws, regulations, or social norms, and then restricting their access to certain services and programs, such as getting loans. Eventually, the program will target petty indiscretions, such as jaywalking, no-shows for restaurant reservations, and not paying transit fare. To date, the social credit system has prevented more than 11 million people from purchasing airline tickets, and 4 million from accessing high-speed rail. But it's not all punitive. Bonus points are awarded to people who donate blood, recycle, or do volunteer work. The point of the system is to root out corruption and lawlessness while promoting pro-social behavior. But its use in a one-party, quasi-totalitarian state is cause for concern among many people. Who gets to decide which rules apply, for example, and if they're fair? Are the severities of the social punishment proportionate to the indiscretion? And does the system really target certain segments of the population, such as citizens from a poor socioeconomic group? And by expanding this system to academic settings, researchers could find themselves unfairly targeted by a system with very little accountability. Jealous rival groups or principal investigators whose sexual advances were turned down could unfairly use the system to threaten or hurt innocent research scientists, among many other possible abuses. Let me drop for a second. Where will all this end? Well, there's a great anthology series, if you've never watched it on television, it's called Black Mirror, and it explores a lot of technological precautionary tales. You know, Facebook and voting people up and voting people down and all kinds of things. It's highly recommended, and it looks like it's going to be what China is going to be like soon. So if you have nothing better to do some night and it's on Netflix, it's called Black Mirror. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
Hey, Joe, love you long time.
Okay, I think I'll wrap this up. I know that that Paul has some interesting things to give for the on the space report tonight, and I just want to remind everyone once again that links to all these different articles, if you want to read more about it, will be on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And if you have any topics that you would like to have me discuss, or questions answered, or refute any of the answers that I gave, feel free. And the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And with that, I'll throw it back to Dick, and then he'll throw it back. So over to you, Dick.
Thank you, Roy. Good stuff. Paul, I think we're going to be hearing about fast radio bursts, and the ones that are now starting to duplicate their point of origin, even though they're a zillion miles away in another galaxy. WS2N, K2RIW, you've got a Paul.
Yes, that's true. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. And yeah, we'll cover that in a minute, but I'll go through a couple of these topics. Not as many topics as normal due to the government lockout. There's plenty of private things going on, but if it has to do with NASA, things have slowed down a bit. There are certain things that continued on, like the flyby of Ultima Thule last week with the New Horizons spacecraft. That was okay, you know. They had that on there. That was televised and everything, but if it's not something that's, you know, already in operation, they are cutting quite a bit of projects throughout the NASA community. But privately, things are doing good. Just a couple of days ago, they had a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base by SpaceX. It launched a Falcon 9 Block 5 version, their modern version. That particular booster could launch up to 10 different times before it's refurbished, and then they could do it over and over again. They hope to get around 100 flights out of that thing, where the original ones, Block 4s, they were getting 2 flights out of it. And then on the second flight, they would just let it go into the Pacific or the Atlantic. They would get rid of it. But these things are being reused. The one that went up Vandenberg the other day was one that was also just used back in September. And it was very successful. The booster itself came back and landed directly dead center on the autonomous drone ship out in the Pacific Ocean. And it successfully got its 10 satellites to orbit. 10 satellites were 10 Iridium satellites. I know we've covered Iridium many times on the net, but this was the final launch of the Iridium. There's now 75 Iridium satellites in orbit, and that's what Iridium needs to complete their constellation. So SpaceX contributed about 7 of those flights. A couple of the other satellites went up on other rockets. But yeah, SpaceX Falcon 9 put up the lion's share of them. So now they have 75 satellites. I think they needed 65 and 10 as a spare in case something fails. Let me drop. That was pretty interesting to see because, again, it wasn't on NASA TV. It's not a NASA project, but it was on the SpaceX webcast. So, well, their flights are, whether it's with NASA or not. One topic I wanted to cover, I know Roy covered it a while back. It was called the DART mission that will be coming up in a couple of years. And DART will be going to asteroid that has a moon going around the asteroid. The idea is to crash this vehicle into the smaller part of the moon. Smaller part of the moon is called the smaller moon is Titanimus, and then you know that's going around a larger one. So the idea is to crash it into this object and then watch it and see how much it changes the orbit of the primary asteroid. And they plan on launching this, I think, in 2021. But now European Space Agency has jumped on the DART bandwagon. About a year after that, they plan on launching their own spacecraft called Hera, H-E-R-A, and they intend on going to the exact same asteroid, and they want to get a close-up of the damage that DART, by the way, DART stands for Double Asteroid Redirect Test Launch Vehicle, launched in 2021, and Hera plans on going there, looking at the results of the impact, and also has two CubeSats on board. Apex is one of them, and there's another one. Apex will eventually land on the asteroid. So the CubeSats have really gotten a boost recently because of Marco 1 and Marco 2, or Marco A and B, they call it. The two CubeSats that went for a ride on the trip to Mars following inside all the way to Mars, and they were very successful. They transmitted signals of inside all the way down as it went down to the surface, and transmitted pictures of the planet itself, and they were both very successful. They sent two up, you know, for redundancy, and both worked 100%, so that was really good to see. And each one had its own propulsion systems on board, and it really worked out well. But that's the story with DART and Hera. So over the next couple of years, we'll follow that. Those two missions, one by NASA and one by European Space Agency. And Hera will also bring along two CubeSats with it. So we'll see how that works. The ultimate goal of that whole thing is to see if you can impact an asteroid to some degree to change its trajectory. If you see something coming toward Earth, and you're able to do that early enough. The idea is that you will be able to change its orbit enough just where it won't hit Earth. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Also, this weekend, the Dragon cargo vehicle, which is presently attached to the International Space Station, which went up there a couple of months ago, will be debarked from the space station, and that will come down to the Pacific Ocean. Right now you have three astronauts on board the International Space Station. We have an American, Ann McLean, and then the Russian, Oleg Kononenko. He's been up there like four different times. Along with astronaut David St. Jacques, he's from Canada, and they'll be joined by another crew going up in February, probably in the middle of February or so, and that crew will contain two American astronauts, one woman and one man. The man is Haig. He went up not too long ago, and he was in that failed mission that had to abort. So they're giving him a second chance, as well as his partner from Russia, the commander. He's going to be going up as well. When they had to abort, they had two people. This time they're going to have three on board. So that's pretty good. That's coming up in February. Money hasn't stopped for the International Space Station. It has something to do with that. Shutdown does not affect that. You have people in mission control 24 hours a day for 65 days a year covering that. They never stopped, even during that hurricane when Hurricane Harvey went through and the whole Houston area got flooded out. They left the crew on at the International Space Station covering the astronauts that were on board. So no change in operation there. Another mission that we followed closely here on the net was the test mission. The test is a spacecraft that is basically replacing, more or less, the Kepler spacecraft. The Kepler spacecraft was launched quite a few years ago, and it detected thousands of planets, exoplanets. Very successful. The difference is test is in a heliocentric orbit, so it's following Earth and actually drifting further and further from Earth as time goes on. But finally it's been abandoned. They stopped working with it due to the failures of gyroscopes. They managed to keep it going to some degree, but eventually it has now run out of fuel. About a few months ago, NASA paid SpaceX to launch the test spacecraft into an orbit that goes out to around the location of the moon, that far out, roughly around 250,000 miles out, and then it comes back near Earth, around 60,000 miles near Earth, not too close to Earth, but close enough where, at that point, that's where it transmits all the data back to Earth. When it's going on a way out toward the orbit of the moon, not that it ever goes near the moon, but it gets out that far, and on the way back, it's taking pictures with its photosensitive CCD cameras. It's got four on board, and it's looking at the light of the stars, thousands of stars. Unlike Kepler looks at stars maybe 6,000 light years away, this thing is only looking at stars maybe 50, 60, or maybe 200 light years away. And it's looking for transits. It's looking for light dimming of the star. And they see that, and they see it on a regular basis. Over time, they know it's a planet. And the first results are in, even so it's only been operational now a couple of months. And they have confirmed three planets, and roughly the same size of Earth, so in that category. And they believe it's already captured thousands of planets that will eventually be confirmed one way or another by ground telescopes. Test sent the information back, they evaluated, and then they get the ground telescopes to look for what test is seeing to confirm whether or not it's really a planet or not. So they've done a terrific job with this thing. It's a two-year mission, and then usually if you follow the NASA spacecraft, they always usually get extended missions. So first couple of months so far have been very, very successful for test. Okay, on not as good of a story for NASA, the Hubble Space Telescope has experienced a hardware problem with the wide field planetary camera. And this is the third one that they've installed over the years. Hubble's course was launched in 1990. So here we are 29 years later. That maybe five different service missions that have gone up there with astronauts over the years, replacing this part, that part, gyros, and cameras. So one of the pieces that they've changed out over the years is this wide field planetary camera, and they did this on the very last mission, and that was 2009 by STS-125, and you know, they said that the hardware piece has failed. Now this thing has redundancy to it, so this camera records visible light, records ultraviolet, as well as infrared light. So, you know, you would think, well, it's a camera, you know, how big could it be, you know? If you ever look at the picture of this thing, it's as big as a, I don't know, like a grand piano. Drop it. And it's attached to this round curvature peak that's part of the outside of the Space Telescope. So when they put this in, it's like putting a drawer, a massive drawer, you know, as big as a piano, into the inside of a Hubble Space Telescope. And built into this thing is redundancy, and NASA said that they are sure they're going to be able to get this thing back into operation. So it was put up in 2009. The Wide Field Planetary Camera Number 3 has never gone over to a backup portion. They haven't used any redundancy parts, and it's loaded with them. Yet, so it looks like right now they're going to probably have to do that. And once they figure out how to do it and exactly what's wrong, they'll do it. They don't want to screw up and break another piece. Let me drop it to WS command. So, with that, they will get that done. They probably would have gotten it done by now, but unfortunately they haven't. Things are slowing down because of the lockout going on in NASA. So they're going to get it done, but some of the work that has to be done, you know, on Earth before they start sending signals up, are slowing down because different departments that they would normally contact to get things accomplished are closed. So they have to go and do a bypass of whatever system that might be. But they'll get it done according to what I've been reading. Let me drop it. Okay, another thing on my list is the Strato launch vehicle. The Strato launch vehicle, we covered on the net many years ago. Every time I see something new with this, I'll talk about it. Strato launch is this airplane. It's a jet plane with 747 engines attached to the wings, and it's a carrier jet, and what they're going to do is eventually attach a spacecraft or a rocket and a spacecraft to this thing, fly it up to 45,000 feet and let it drop, and they will have their own rockets and launch into space. The first mission that they plan on doing is probably another year or two away. And that will be with a Pegasus rocket for NASA. But they have their own rockets that they're developing as well, and much bigger than the Pegasus rocket, and, which will eventually be able to carry, you know, not only 300 kilograms to orbit, but, you know, up to 6,000 kilograms to orbit. And someday down the road, they plan on launching people from this thing, like a small Dream Chaser type of spacecraft. They plan on eventually dropping in sending a crew of maybe two to orbit. But that's a long-term goal, and over the last year and a couple of months, they've been testing this vehicle. We have a gigantic hangar out in the Mojave Spaceport, and once in a while, they bring this out to the runway, and they run it down the runway. The first time they did it, they pulled it out with a truck, make sure it was okay. It's got
I don't know how many wheels attached to it. Very heavy. And the wingspan is as long as the International Space Station. It's longer than a football field. That's how long the wingspan is on this vehicle. And then eventually they fired up the jets. Time went on.